Our next case for argument this morning is Lasley against Moss. Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Your Honor. For the record, my name is Milford Miller. I represent John Moss, the appellant in this case. This case arises from a jury verdict of medical malpractice in July of this year. We raised 2 points on appeal. The first point deals with the issue of liability, and the second, one of damages. The first point deals with the fact that the trial court refused to provide an instruction we tendered on the Indiana informed consent presumption. And that, we believe, was error. The court applied a standard which is perhaps a federal standard, but not an Indiana standard. This is a diversity case, and because the case involves the court's diversity jurisdiction, any question regarding jury instructions needs to be resolved under Indiana law, as this court decided in the Golikowski case in 52 Federal 3rd, 1439 in 1995. It is our position, Your Honor, that the instruction we tendered was appropriate. It was appropriate both under the Indiana Rules of Evidence, Rule 301, and it was appropriate based upon the evidence that's in the case.
The Indiana Rules of Evidence certainly don't apply in federal court.
Well, I believe they do, Your Honor, with respect to the fact that
federal rules of evidence determine rules of evidence in federal court. The exception of Rule 501, which says that the Indiana law of privileges applies, but that's not what you're arguing about.
Well, I get it is that we were entitled to an instruction of rebuttable presumption.
But then your instruction didn't include 12-3, right? Which gave an explanation as to how Lasley could overcome the presumption, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
But the instruction you tendered was really half of the instruction. You gave the instruction on the rebuttable presumption. But then you never tendered the rest. Well, this is under a different statute, 12-3, that set out for the jury how you can overcome a rebuttable. No, how the consent, that's what it was. 12-3 deals with what constitutes consent.
That's correct.
And in order for the jury to interpret, you know, the part of the instruction that you did give, I mean, to me, it was an incomplete. That's the problem I have. You gave an incomplete instruction.
I'd call your honest attention to the court's colloquy with respect to the instruction that we gave. That colloquy we maintain both acknowledged in the court's mind that he would be giving, if he felt it were appropriate to give the instruction at all, he would be giving Section 3. And that colloquy appears in Document 106, page 461. And I think it's important that the court review what is said. And the court is saying, what we've got is the one scheme where we give it to the jury and tell them it is your burden to show this, and your burden to show that if we use that, I would have to give the third section, which would just lead them, meaning the jury, through a second process, which amounts to the same thing we are doing. In other words, not only do we say it is the plaintiff's burden to show that this consent that she signed was uninformed, it would again tell them that it is presumed to be uninformed if, or it is presumed to be under Section 2, unless under Section 3 certain things aren't meant. And it turns out to be the same thing. It is the same process we put them through. There is no need to have an extra set of instructions on this. And this Kedek versus West actually supports that idea. Now, Your Honor, instructions 14, 15, and 16, tendered by the plaintiff, all discuss the elements of Section 3. And that is what the court is referring to when the court says we are no need to put them through this again. So what the court is essentially saying is that this instruction is not appropriate because the court has made a determination, essentially a determination directing that the verdict on, or the directing that the jury not be entitled to hear that in Indiana there is a presumption that a signed consent that is valid. And it is our position that under the evidence and under the instructions of the court, we are entitled to that in Indiana with respect to what the presumption is, rebuttable presumption, with respect to the issue of consent. The court clearly understands, and the people who are listening to the court when the court is discussing our tender, that Section 3 would be given if Section 2 would be given. Yet the court says, I'm not going to do that. It isn't necessary. So we maintain under Rule 51D that the court has essentially made plain error by refusing to consider in any event an instruction on a rebuttable presumption on the issue of informed consent. The court cites the Cadet case. The Cadet case, we submit, is not a principle, does not support the principle that the instruction is not appropriate. The Cadet case is a summary judgment case. It comes up on summary judgment. It is a case where, in several instances, there were affidavits tendered by the medical review panel that were in opposition to the doctor's affidavit and position with respect to the motion for summary judgment. I think it is clear that in the context of a summary judgment proceeding, a rebuttable presumption as a part of a jury instruction would not be the basis for a determination on behalf of the defendant that the informed consent issue was not one as to which there were material evidence. We are dealing, however, in a jury trial. We are dealing in a context where there was evidence on both sides with respect to what was said by the doctor to the patient, with respect to what with respect to what the actual harm would be, what the circumstances of the surgery would be, what the alternatives were. If the court can make a determination that under Indiana law, that the position of Indiana, and call it whatever, social position or whatever, it doesn't make any difference, that Indiana recognizes a presumption, rebuttable presumption, that in the case of a signed consent, that this consent was freely and given with understanding, then I agree that the appellant has no position in this case.
You're in your rebuttal time, you understand.
Right. Thank you very much, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time with respect to rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Mr. Garrow.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Jerry Garrow. I'm here on behalf of the Lasleys. The instruction that was tendered by the defendants was not a complete statement of the law. The instruction was taken verbatim from IND Code 341812-2. That statute must be read in conjunction with the subsequent statute, 34-1812-3. 34-1812-3 makes clear that the rebuttable presumption under 12-2 only arises if there is a showing that the patient has received a full explanation of the alternatives to the proposed treatment and the risk of the proposed treatment.
Does Indiana have standard jury instructions?
Yes, Your Honor.
The instruction that was tendered, is that in that?
Yes, Your Honor. The 3418.12.2 instruction tendered by the defendants was not a pattern jury instruction. The pattern jury instructions on informed consent were tendered and were given by the court, but the patterns do not include the language from 3418.12.2.
Why not?
Because, Your Honor, first, it's typically accepted that instructions regarding presumption or saying presumption are not favored. I think that's clear in the Schultz case cited in the briefs.
But if they have a rule on presumptions and how they're considered, that there, if something is presumed, they don't instruct them. They just, how does the information get conveyed to the jury that they're entitled to presume?
Your Honor, I think with respect to the presumption under 3418.12.2, I think that language or the jury being informed of a presumption or that there is
certainly this is not the only time the word presumption is used when we're discussing what the jury can consider and what it can presume, is it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not sure I understand.
I say
your
there
question.
Are other instances in Indiana law where the jury is entitled to presume something from something else. Was
certainly,
there,
Your Honor.
And there are instructions concerning those?
There are instructions. I don't believe they're in the patterns. The Schultz case, which is discussed in the brief.
You mean outside the pattern, you have to go wandering around loose to find out where something.
I think that's the case, Your Honor, with respect to statutory presumptions that are created. The Schultz case talks about a presumption in a products liability case. And in that case, the court goes through, and the court ultimately accepted the instruction that was tendered in the Schultz case, but the court noted that in these types of cases, this instruction should refrain from using the legal term presumption. If you use that term, you should make sure that you establish in the instruction what is necessary to rebut the presumption and what the plaintiff has to show to rebut the presumption. Uh-huh. In this case, we have an instruction that was tendered that was taken, as I said, verbatim from the statute.
Is there anything in the pattern jury instructions that discusses what you have to do to overcome a presumption?
No, Your Honor. The patterns...
You paused at a threshold of a great, brilliant legal thing. Why doesn't Indiana address the issue if it's available to you?
I'm not sure why the drafters of the pattern instructions do not include...
We've got to inquire of them, you know.
You should check with the drafters, Your Honor. But the patterns, the Indiana pattern jury instructions do not discuss presumption, particularly in this setting of informed consent. And I'm not aware of any of the patterns that discuss presumption and what is necessary to overcome.
Do they in the criminal pattern instructions discuss presumptions?
Your Honor, I am completely out of my realm when we talk about the criminal pattern instructions. I'm not sure what the criminal pattern
But you're vastly familiar with the civil jury.
I am familiar with the civil instructions with respect to negligence and medical malpractice, Your Honor. With respect to the instruction tendered in this case, establishment of information being provided to the patient regarding alternatives and risk of the treatment, those are conditions preceding to the establishment of the rebuttable presumption. The defendant in this case simply did not tender a complete statement of the law, and the court was correct in rejecting it.
Well, even if it was incomplete, shouldn't the district court have instructed the jury on the presumption issue?
Your Honor,
that seems like an important point. I still don't get I understand you're saying it's disfavored, but I don't understand why it's even in the books if it can't be used.
Your Honor, in this case, taking Mr. Miller's argument and assuming that Section 3 of the statute had been tendered and that the instruction had been given, what Judge McKinney was saying is correct. What we have here is the conditions precedent to the establishment of the presumption are a full disclosure of the risk and alternatives to the proposed treatment. The jury did receive instructions with regard to that they had to find in order on the issue of informed consent that Dr. Moss gave Mrs. Lassley a full discussion of the risk and alternatives to the proposed treatment. However, as the jury was instructed, if the jury found that explanation was given, if the jury found that Dr. Moss did give Mrs. Lassley a full explanation of the risk and benefits of the treatment, of the proposed treatment, and the alternatives to the treatment, Dr. Moss got something far better than a presumption. He got a jury verdict in his favor. That was the issue for liability, was did he give the information required by 3418.12.3? And if the jury found that he did give that information, he got better than what Section 2 gives him. He got a jury verdict in his favor.
You wouldn't have to rely on presumption then.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You wouldn't have to rely on the presumption.
There was no need for the presumption, and the instructions that Dr. Moss got were better than a presumption. He got a verdict if he showed that he met the conditions precedent to the establishment of the presumption.
So all the elements of 12.3 were in an instruction?
Yes, Your Honor. Essentially, the elements, what 12.3 lays out is informed consent.
And which instruction encompassed all the elements of 12.3?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I can't think of the exact numbers, but I believe it was the numbers immediately preceding the tendered instruction. They told the jury, they were from the patterns, and they told the jury.
If you find that is what the instruction starts on, if you find that he gave him consent or he informed her completely of what the things were, then you should find in favor of the defendant.
That was the only issue.
Was that the instruction that was given?
I believe that was, in essence, the instruction that was given. In terms of the exact wording, Your Honor, I do not have that in front of me. I can find that exact wording for you. But that was the essence of the plaintiff's case. There was no other allegation.
How many instructions were given?
Approximately 16, Your Honor, I believe.
Well, I could probably wade through it myself if there's only 16. If it gets up to 60, I quit.
there certainly were not 60, Your Honor, but that was the only element of the plaintiff's case. This was a pure informed consent case. There were no other allegations of negligence. There were no allegations that the surgery performed was negligent. The only issue presented to the jury was informed consent. And if the jury found that the conditions precedent required...
It's the only issue before this court on your theory is that the jury was informed as to what their duties were and what would happen if they found a particular thing.
Our position before this court is the jury was adequately instructed on informed consent and that the instruction tendered by the defendants on that issue, the statutory instruction, was not a complete and accurate statement of the law. The defendants have also raised an issue regarding mitigation of damages, Your Honor. On that issue, we believe that there is we received a judgment on the evidence on mitigation of damages at the close of the evidence. There was no evidence that any conduct by Mrs. Lassley caused or contributed to injuries, to a definable, quantifiable injury that she suffered.
Well, he didn't argue that, but just she didn't go to a doctor for some period of time afterwards.
She went after the surgery through May. She did not go to her July appointment. Well, and then she sought a new otolaryngologist after that point in time. There is no testimony, however, that her decision not to go after that point contributed to or caused an identifiable, quantifiable additional injury to her. There is absolutely no testimony.
Was there any testimony that if she gone to a doctor, her condition might have been better?
I don't believe there's any testimony to that effect. There is testimony from Dr. Moss that if her calcium levels were out of whack.
or not
properly adjusted during that time, she could have been jittery. It could have made her voice worse. But no one testified that in fact happened. No one, more important, Your Honor, no one testified that if she would have continued to see Dr. Moss, that Dr. Moss would have done anything during that period of time different.
Well, he wasn't
from
complaining
what she received.
About not seeing him. He was complaining about not seeing anybody. If she
Your
didn't
Honor,
have faith
and,
in him, she
And, Your
see.
Honor, actually, she did continue to receive treatment during that period of time.
From whom?
From her family practice physician. The record is undisputed on the fact that she continued to receive medications for her calcium deficiency.
But not anybody who specialized in the problem she had.
Your Honor, if I may answer the question, not an endocrinologist who specialized in the problem she had, and Dr. Moss was not an endocrinologist.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Miller?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
The instructions that were given that I believe Mr. Garrow has agreed would be Section 3 instructions were essentially the ones I mentioned, 14, 15, and 16, Your Honor. And those, as Mr. Garrow said, do cover Section 3. And I go back to the colloquy.
Why would you need an instruction on presumption if you put in direct evidence?
The difference is this, Your Honor, as I see it, is that the instruction on presumption says there is a rebuttable presumption in favor of the doctor that the consent, if it is written, was an informed consent. That's a rebuttable presumption.
Right.
And
they were told if she got enough instruction and informed consent, that you win.
Yes, Your Honor, but if you accept that reason, it's a circular. You would never give an instruction on a presumption.
You would if you... No. If she says, I didn't read it, I don't know what I was reading. I didn't read it. I didn't pay any attention. I didn't understand it. Now all the presumption kicks in. But she didn't say that, did she? She didn't say that, did she?
No, she most certainly did not.
Well, I mean, you don't need a presumption problem. She says, I did. I read it.
Because there is disputed testimony. Disputed testimony on the issues as to which she has the burden of proof.
Issue of what?
On the issue as to what the proper treatment was, what the risks...
But that has nothing to do with her presumption, with the presumption of the informed consent. The question is, did he tell her, and was it? Did she understand it? That's the only thing. And that I think, was already in. That's done.
And that requires a jury decision, and Indiana law says the presumption exists, a rebuttable presumption, that the doctor did give an informed consent.
Yeah, but that is the point is whether or not what she did, what the doctor did, produced the problem that she has, not whether she was consented to it or not. Okay.
I believe, Your Honor, that particular approach, however, would any time there were evidence that on the basis of the patient who said this thing and that thing, that the presumption
if
would
she
disappear.
Says, I read it and I didn't understand it, then the presumption kicks in. But if she doesn't say that, why is there a need for a presumption?
Because the elements of informed consent go beyond simply the reading of the document itself. They go to the internal aspects of what is said about the treatment and such.
Thank you, counsel.
With respect to the mitigation of... Pardon me?
Your light's on.
I'm sorry.
Boom.
Okay. Thank you.
Case is taken under advisement.